This is Nick Beer, interviewed at his home at Lanford, near Salisbury in Wiltshire, on the 15th of February 2009, by Chris Eldon Lee. Nick Beer, Part 2.
What for you are the most interesting parts of the daily routine of a ship's captain? What do you have to do and what do you enjoy? Or perhaps
I suppose on the James Clark Ross, most of the time we were a scientific research platform. So the daily routine there was very much when we were at sea and conducting scientific research is very much that of a manager going around making sure that every part of the operation was working correctly and that people were happy. And one of the things I think, I'm not sure whether I'm sort of blowing my own trumpet, but one of the things that I like to think that I brought to the James Clark Ross was a feeling or a sense that actually the crew were on board this scientific research ship in order to supply a service to the customer, who was the scientist. And I think, you know, there had been although, you know, that wasn't totally an alien concept to what had happened in Bass previously, I always felt that was really important for the James Clark Ross, in particular because we would have overseas foreign scientific customers. So and this took a bit of getting through to the crew that it wasn't just a question that when the scientists wanted something done, it wasn't just a question that they were being awkward and annoying, that you know, they had every right to expect us to provide that service if we could. And so daily routine was to make sure that people were happy and that content with the sort of service, the scientists were content with the sort of service that the ship was giving to them. And on the other hand, that the crew were also content that they were getting the sort of satisfaction that I hoped that they would from doing a good job and doing a good job well. So it was sort of manipulating people and man management, I suppose, each and every day.
That suggests that to some there may have been instances where it was new thinking that science came first.
I think that's true. I think it was to some on board.
How did that manifest itself? Were they reluctant to? Was there reluctance? Naming their names.
Not a reluctance. No, I think that the Bass crews have always worked well, reasonably well, with scientists. But scientists are their own worst enemies, or had been in the past. They're rather demanding, rather unsympathetic to the position of the crew on board, and so that there were fences to mend, I think, on both from both angles, both sides. The crew, I don't remember particularly a lot of friction in the past, but I know from the crew's aspect that they found scientists irritating, and they could have done without them, basically. Where the alternative theory is that without the scientists, we wouldn't be in a job, or we would have no service to operate.
Yeah, but if you're a seaman with the British Antarctic Survey, your job is to get the scientists to their wooden huts on land and forget about them, isn't it?
That's part of it, and that may be part of where the mentality sort of came from. And there are, I mean, these bands of these different passengers that we carry on board a ship like the James Clark Ross are very different. They are very different categories. So the scientist that's going down, just left university, is going down to the base for his 2 years excitement and adventure is a different personality to the scientist who may be 10, 15 years older, who's doing this for his living, permanent job, and they have to be treated somewhat differently.
Did you have flashpoints there? I seem to recall there was a possibility that the scientists would not get home for Christmas at one point. because you're having to divert the ship for other purposes.
Well, that's quite likely. I don't remember that in specific, but that sort of thing happened on a number of occasions, and you know that was the sort of would have been an irritating trait being shown by the scientists. The scientists could be equally bad at understanding, of seeing things from the crew's point of view. I remember once in particular where we had we were doing some scientific research off South Georgia, and there was an emergency, a Mayday call from a ship. I can't remember precisely.
It was in French. French
shops? It could well have been. It could well have been something like that. But we, as seamen, we received a Mayday call, and there was no question that we would respond to that call. But the scientists at that time just could not, you know, did not want to countenance that. They were so focused on making the best of every hour in every 24 hours of every day, that there was an argument about whether we could do that, and in the end, the particular case that I'm thinking of, the Mayday was cancelled. It wasn't a false alarm, but somebody else had responded, and it was no longer something that we needed to go to. So, the potential flashpoint was nullified by something that occurred outside of the ship. So that was a problem solved.
Was that an eye-opener for you? Were you horrified by that?
Not horrified. Not horrified. But I mean, because there were certain scientists where you would expect that, because it's just a blinkered approach, not really understanding that there are other responsibilities.
Mm. So there was a potential clash of cultures. Because
there was, yeah, and that's what had to be faced up to try. I mean, that was what I was attempting to mollify and make it work, really. So that rather than have two different teams on board doing the same job, but not really working together.
So what were your tactics, Nick?
I spoke to the crew. I spoke to the crew and the officers on several occasions and explained what I wanted. And the key person to that was the chief officer. And so the chief officer had to believe that we were there as a service provider, and that because of that, there was a different way that we needed to speak to the scientific teams on board in a different way. And instead of waiting for them to necessarily ask us for things, we should be inquiring what they needed. And I think with he and I doing that, and everyone understanding that there was a different management style on board, that seemed to work.
There's a quite nice passage in one of your reports where you talk about the scientists and the FIDs and the seamen all getting together to load or unload a base, and note at the end that was good for bonding and morale.
It was, and that was one of the barriers that had to be taken down, because the scientists did not want to be called FIDs, and they did not. You'll be aware that the FIDs on board, the generic term for those that are going down to the Antarctic bases that we're carrying as passengers on board the ship, really. Down to the Antarctic base where they would do their work. The FIDs had to work on board. They have to assist with the cargo work. They were all part of the team, which the ship's crew were also a component part, the big team. And scientists when the John Biscoe became a science platform, because it was just a logistics ship initially, when it became a science platform, that was something that the scientists disliked. The true marine scientists disliked being called FIDS. And there was an occasion in this dual role where certainly some occasions where the fact that the scientists were also part of this big team, which was BASS, had to be put to the test, as it were, and that occurred where we visited a base where other BASS employees were existing and carrying out their own science, and where labour was needed in order to transport goods ashore. And then the scientists did not want to be FIDS, did not want to be part of that, did not feel that it was in their job description to go down in the hold and help load cargo and transport it ashore or whatever. But that was our labour force. That's the way that the Antarctic logistics works. It's the scientists or the FIDS or provide the labour, the muscle to be able to do that.
So were you finding yourself putting your foot down?
I had to on that occasion, on a few occasions, but it would have been with the chief scientists, who generally were sympathetic, and eventually, I seem to remember there was always one or two scientists that just stuck out and just to make a point said that it wasn't their role, but I think generally people felt a bit sorry for them, because they had an opportunity to be part of this big exciting adventure, really, and they chose to just be passengers at that time in the voyage.
That became a major responsibility then, really, for the ship's captain.
I wouldn't want to blow it out of proportion. No. It was a minor irritation, really. I mean, another minor irritation along similar lines was that, with the constant difficulty with a few scientists to try and keep some sort of dress code in the dining room. You'll be aware that the James Clark Ross has a combined dining room between the with the scientists and the officers, and also a crew mess room. And one of the conditions, really, that I put for my part in not having separate dining facilities for the officers, as we had on the Biscoe and on the Bransfield, was that we would maintain standards of steward service and certainly as far as the officers were concerned, of wearing uniform, which I felt was very important. But a number of the scientists objected to having to wear a tie to go to dinner, despite the fact that the steward would be dressed in his bow tie and be clean and tidy and prepared to wait on him at table. So there were constant battles there with certain scientists that wanted to stand up for their right not to wear a tie.
So your general role on board the ship then was as much to do with the harmony amongst the humans as it was to do with getting the machinery in the right place. Let me rephrase that. We were, as captain, were you delegating nearly all the mechanical functions?
Yes. The chief engineer looked after the smooth running of the engine room spaces and the winches on deck, and with the help of the chief officer. So the technical running of the vessel, of the machinery, including the winches on deck, was the chief engineer's responsibility.
So the navigation, all that kind of stuff, was done by subordinates?
Yeah.
The navigation
was still came under my remit. I like to think that I was orchestrating all of this and making sure that it happened in the way that a a general manager would. And there was an awful lot of paperwork, communications and meetings to be had, safety committee meetings, and emails and what have you to answer, refit lists to oversee the preparation of them. So there was more than enough hours every day.
Who decided it was time to weigh anchor and move?
Me.
Right.
Well, yes, that's true, but all those decisions were mine on the ship. But I would meet with the chief scientists several times a day, and perhaps officially at least once a day, but we would be talking several times each day. And all this had to be coordinated. The reason that I'd be weighing anchor is in order to perhaps go to start a scientific program, and there wouldn't be no point in weighing anchor until the chief scientist is ready. So, and in order to be ready, the chief scientist would need the help of the crew in preparing equipment and making ready for the start of the program, or indeed to go to sea and get everything secured on deck. So. It was coordinating all those things
and you would make all the weather decisions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Without a doubt, anything to do with safety would be my responsibility.
But you also have the longer view. Then you were making recommendations for what happened to the ship when she got back to Britain, what improvements for next season.
Yes.
All that kind of stuff as well.
Yes, but also coordinating the views of the other key players, including the chief scientist, chief officer, chief engineer.
It says here, typical day. Was there one?
No. Every day was different. I suppose that the days at sea on a scientific programme could be fairly tedious. I mean, if nothing was going wrong, then it could be fairly tedious for the master. But normally, and especially during the logistics phases, every day was full of challenges that needed to be met and overcome.
How do you weigh up conditions? Is it purely experience, or are you more these days in the 1990s more reliant upon technology?
You use technology, but I mean it is experience as well. You couldn't. I mean, it wouldn't matter what experience you had on ships. You wouldn't be able to take a ship into the Antarctic safely without some experience of the environment and the problems that the Antarctic throws at you. So that it's a combination of what you've seen before, what you've learnt from other people, your peers. And what technology can do to help you make those decisions, especially if you're working ice, then technology these days is an essential tool to do it efficiently. Satellite imagery and perhaps the use of on polar stern, it would be use of helicopters to fly ahead of the ship to try and find where the weakest spots are. One challenge on Jane Scott Ross, which I thoroughly enjoyed, was as a scientific cruise with Nick Owens, who's now the director of BASS, but he was the principal scientist, and the task was to go into the ice and to get stuck, basically to get as far into the sea ice as possible and until the ship could go no further. And to get stuck, and then to drift with that ice, as the ice melted back during the summer, to stay in that position in the ice and carry out scientific monitoring experiments. But normally, when you're trying to avoid ice, or certainly not trying to get stuck, this was the opposite, trying to find ice that was thick enough to to actually get stuck for a month or so.
How did navigation change in your 20-odd years with Bass?
Tremendously, as it did in the world, the maritime world generally. But when in 1972 there was no satellite navigation at all, so everything was done by sextant and traditional methods. one of my first voyage, probably my first voyage to the Antarctic, we attempted, because we'd heard that the southern end of the Weddell Sea, that a large iceberg had broken off during the early spring. We thought there was an opportunity to get a record, the furthest south that any ship had ever gone, and this is only possible in one area of the Ross Sea, and it's feasible in the Weddell Sea as well. So we thought we'd go down, and we had some time to kill. I think we were waiting for something on the base at Halley, and we went as far south as we could, and we were convinced on our dead reckoning position that we were the farthest south. But in order to claim this record for the Guinness Book of Records, we had to actually obtain a position by sextant altitude. But we were surrounded by ice cliffs, so we had no horizon. So I remember, as I was the navigator, being tasked to go down and take a sight of the sun reflected in water with antifreeze in it. So I took a bucket of water, and it was the angle between the bucket of water, the surface of the water, and the sun. Actually, we calculated it at noon and got the latitude. Unfortunately, the Guinness Book of Records didn't accept the method. But navigation was very traditional.
What was the biggest leap forward?
Well, satellite navigation, and although some of us diehard sort of kept the sextant going for several years, making sure that the satellite navigator was correct, in the end that we realised it was a lost cause, so that the satellite navigator was far more accurate than our sextant. So we chucked the sextants away, and then with the with satellite navigation, the next stage, were over years, the satellite navigation became much more reliable and dependable and accurate, until electronic charts appeared on the James Clark Ross, and so from that point of view, you knew where you were all the time. And in the days prior to satellite navigation, or prior to the really reliable satellite navigation, there were occasions when you really didn't know where you were. You perhaps working ice in cloudy conditions, so there was no chance of any sights of the stars or the sun for days, and you're zigzagging through ice. You could be, your dead reckoning position could be way, way, way out. So, big change to satellite navigation, and then GPS, where you know where you are.
In your time, GPS.
Yes, yeah. Yes, GPS.
And were you also getting electronic information towards the end of your time about ice conditions, ice flows, positions of ice?
No, the weather information's always, in the Antarctic, has always been pretty...
Average.
Yeah. I mean, you could depend on a low coming through the Drake Passage, sort of once every two or three days. So, I mean, you didn't need a forecaster to tell you that was going to happen, and what sort of effect that would have on your ship, depending on where you were in relation to the Drake Passage. So that was one certainty about the weather generally, but. Once you got down the Antarctic Peninsula, it was because there was no recording stations out to the west where the weather was coming from. It was very difficult to estimate, and also the local effects were so dramatic on the Antarctic Peninsula that they often were far more influential on the ship than the weather system that happened to be around at the time.
Do you think all this technological advancement reduced risk-taking or increased risk-taking because he had a greater confidence of what was out there?
I would say, I mean, I actually have never thought about this, I must say, but I would say that it's probably, risk-taking has probably decreased, but that's not because of the technology. I think it's more that the people's perception of risk has changed, and the health and safety legislation and things has made people much more aware that of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. So I would say that it's a far safer place now, but that's probably not the technology, or not just the technology, it's just the state of mind as well. Less risks are taken.
Did you enjoy? I mean, to work in ICE again, you build up a backbone of experience.
Yes.
Was that all? Were you ever surprised?
We were constantly, really, because it was very unpredictable. I mean, we had information from the Americans, especially Americans ICE reports. But they were usually taken from satellite imagery. The forecasts were formed from satellite imagery, and when you came down to what you're interested in on the ship is what's a quarter of a mile around you or half a mile around you. If you were stuck in ice or you were in particularly thick ice, you were interested in your immediate vicinity, and that on that scale the American forecasts were of not of any use at all, really. You could see sometimes with the faxed facsimile reports, maps of where ICE was and how thick and how concentrated the ice was. It looked good on paper, but in practice, it just didn't. When you actually got there, it didn't look like that at all. Or you could see sometimes apparently great lumps of open water that you were sitting in, and you know it wasn't open water, and yet this satellite image had seemed to have actually indicated that. It was incorrect and unreliable, so you had to work more on your own sort of gut feeling and experience in making your way down to Halley Bay or making your way down to Rothera in the early part of the season. You could look at what the weather had been like from the base's weather forecasts over the previous few days, and get a judgment how tight the ice would be pressed up against the coast of Adelaide Island. If you got stuck or nearly stuck, you constantly worried about the wind direction and other factors, currents that might be affecting the drift of the ice, because the most dangerous time was when you got stuck in brash ice, which is usually the ice we seem to get stuck in there, what we call porridge, because it clung to the ship. The friction the friction effect was so great that you just could not move. Occasionally, it just sort of closed around you, and you couldn't move. Eventually, if it tightened up, you couldn't move backwards or forwards. But then the wind would ease, or the tide would change, and then this whole sheet of ice that you were stuck in would be moving, and it would be taking you
where it wanted,
and you had no control over it, and it would flow over rocks and reefs, whereas you would ground, so that would potentially the some of the most worrying times were in that area off the. These occurred off the southwest corner of Adelaide Island, where you were threading in between reefs and the main mainland of the main part of the island, and where in the early part of the season especially you encountered this sort of porridge that was particularly bad. The Bransfield was stuck there several times badly, and we were only saved from going over this particular reef because the flow took us by a grounded iceberg, and we were able to nip in behind the grounded iceberg and then sit in the lee of the iceberg as the ice streamed past. But the Biscoe, you probably know about, but they were not so lucky. They were in exactly the same position on another occasion, and they actually had to abandon ship. The Polar Stern came to their rescue, and they were the whole crew walked off the Biscoe, walked across this compacted brash ice, and boarded the Polar Stern and went up to Anvers, the American base at Anvers Island, Palmer Station, and then came back about two or three days later, expecting to find the ship marooned on this reef, only to find that the ice had virtually disappeared and it was safely anchored there. They got back on board, started the engines and continued on their way.
Jack Tolson asked me to ask you if you thought you were lucky to be alive. What was he referring to?
I don't know what Jack would be. Yeah, I would. I don't know. I don't know what he'd be referring to there. But there was there were a number of occasions where it was pretty hairy. I think probably the most dangerous one was at Halley Bay when we were struggling to do a major relief of the base. I think it may have even been a rebuild year. The first rebuild of Halley Bay, the Halley base that I was involved with, it would have been 1973, something like that, where there was not very satisfactory ice conditions for our cargo work, and we were forced to actually go alongside an ice cliff, and to discharge cargo up on top of the ice cliff, and we had finished the cargo operations completely. We'd managed over a period of about two or three weeks there, we'd managed to get all this cargo off in different locations. But as the ice broke back, and we had to keep repositioning the ship until we eventually ended up on this ice shelf, which was about 40 foot high, 40 or 50 foot high, and we got the last of the cargo away, and within an hour of the cargo work completing and all the people that normally associated unloading the unhooking the loads from the ship and then loading up the sledges by hand and lashing them, there would have been probably 10 or more people there, FIDs and crew, but it was within an hour of that finishing that the edge of the ice collapsed onto the ship. Probably about 3 or 4 metres of the ice edge broke back and fell on the ship, crushed all the bulwark rails. Fortunately, nobody was hurt at all. But as I say, an hour previously, we could have had 10 or more people died, and me being one of them, because I had been working out there. So, and that was about the third occasion on that particular cargo relief where we'd had pretty dicey situations with ice breaking back. We'd been on a lower we'd been working on bay ice at Halley. The base is actually built where it is because there are some natural indentations in the ice edge that seem to despite the fact that the ice edge breaks back, it seems that these chips, they were called, keep reappearing, and they allow sea ice to form and a ramp to form at its head, so you can drive vehicles up from the sea ice up onto the ice shelf. And if the sea ice is there, if you get there at the right time, then that's fine. But if you get there too late in a particular season and the sea ice is gone, then all you've got is the snow ramp to go alongside. And if that breaks back, there's no warning, and it just breaks into very small lumps that just roll over and disappear. So any body or anything on the ice at that stage is lost, basically. And we'd had one occasion where that had broken back on the ramp, and there was no ramp left, and that's the... But again, nobody was hurt. It would happened at the middle of night. There was nobody working at the time. And it was this second time that we went alongside the ice cliff that it actually caused quite a bit of damage on the ship. And we were all out there with pickaxes trying to... Because the ship had a 5 or 10 degree list. And we were out there with pickaxes and shovels trying to break the ice and shovel it overboard.
When you got back to your cabin...
Mm.
What was going through your mind?
I suppose as ship's crew, you don't think about it until afterwards. And probably, as you say, you go back to your cabin. It's all done. You've got you've been out probably working out there for several hours, getting all this ice off the deck. And you just think, well, it was very lucky escape, I suppose. And you generally very nervous about it, but fortunately we didn't have any more cargo to work there.
The one thing about that incident, as I understand it, was there was no way you could predict it
no.
or prevent it.
Well,
or could
no, you couldn't prevent it. The only way you could prevent it is by not being there in the first place. It's one of those questions that masters of bash ships are asking continuously, because it's easy to say no, I'm not going to do that job because it's that particular relief, or I'm going to stop that relief, I'm not going to allow that boat to go away because in my estimation it's too dangerous. But if you took that too far, then you would never get the work done, and you'd be the safest master alive, but you wouldn't
you'd be
unemployed probably, yeah. Well, no, you wouldn't get the job done. And several of one particular ship's masters was more cautious than others. And you have to respect him for it because he had his views and he stuck by them. And he did the job, but it generally took him a lot longer because he'd make the ship wait around. He'd keep the ship waiting around longer till the right weather came along. And it's usually weather dependent. It was always working boats in poor weather, or committing the vessel to ice, committing the ship to ice. Those are the big decisions that the master was making, if not a daily basis and a weekly basis down in the Antarctic.
So there was a lot of agonising involved, Nick.
Yes, a lot of decisions to be made, and. And then once you've made a decision, you're committed to it. You've got to get on with it and make the best of it.
Committed decisions or captain's decisions?
Oh, no, captain's decisions. I mean, if you're working boats, then I would talk to the mate. I mean, I'd definitely talk to the person that is actually going to go and do the job. But eventually, it has to be ultimately the master's decision whether the boat goes, or whether we commit the ship to ice.
Do you remember ever having a sinking feeling where you'd made the decision to go ahead with the operation and partway through you wish you hadn't?
Yeah, oh, definitely. It's Bird Island at several occasions. I remember one time in particular where we lifted, because it was too dangerous. It was on the James Clark Ross. And it was too dangerous to actually get people out of the landing craft onto a vertical ladder and climb up the ship's side. The weather had deteriorated so rapidly that we had to lift the whole landing craft with everybody in it. And we had about 20 people in it. And the light was fading. It was, it would have been normally these really hairy times at Bird Island were late in the season when you were trying to do the final relief, the final visit, picking up the rubbish from the base, that sort of thing, in March. And we had to pick up the landing craft with, as I say, 20 or more people in it. and it was dodgy, really. But there wasn't the alternative. When I thought about it afterwards, the alternative would have been to say, no, you go back into Bird Island and you stay there. But the likelihood would have been that they'd have been there for 2 or 3 days before we'd have been able to come back. The weather was blowing up. It was pretty well forecasted. That's why I sort of blame myself maybe for making the decision in the first place. I have to say I was really nervous about that, and my heart was in my mouth when we were lifting up this boat. I was standing on the bridge watching it. I mean, I wasn't actually doing it, because it had something gone wrong at that stage. All those people would have been dead if one of the strops that we were lifting the boat with had parted or something. With the extra strain, because I forget the weight of the boat itself, but you're talking about 12 tons or so of boat plus all the people, and then this jerk load as the crane started to take the weight and a wave would fall away, you get a sudden tension on the line. Something could have the system had not been tested. With those sort of conditions in mind, and had something gone, then we'd have had a major disaster on our hands, and I would have been to blame. I know that probably. I mean, at the time, I mean that was one of a number of occasions like that. But at the time, you're the adrenaline's flowing. You've just got to get on with it. You're making sure that it's done. I mean, I made the decision that they weren't going to climb up the ladders, because I think that would have been too dangerous. This, to me, was a safer way of doing it, and yet it had its own inherent risks. We would have had a Zodiac in the water at that stage, but a Zodiac and 20 people wouldn't have been able to do anything. May have been able to pick 2 or 3 people out of the water, but that's all. But anyway, you're just getting on with it, and you're trying to make it as safe as possible. And it all works out, and nobody's hurt. And actually, they thought it was all quite exciting. But sometimes when I think back on it now, with the knowledge that I have as an accident investigator, where I've investigated similar sort of disasters of similar magnitude anyway, and I've seen what it's done to that master that's been involved, and his sanity, basically, let alone his career or whatever, I think that they're there but for the grace of God go I, and I think that's helped me in the role as accident investigator, because I can't afford to be too judgmental, I know that it could so easily be me half the time. I mean, sometimes people are more reckless, but often accidents are just the sort of things that could easily have happened in the Antarctic.
I asked you earlier whether you felt you had Antarctic captains have a shorter shelf life, or perhaps the question should have been, do they burn out faster than captains who are not in? Because you're in the Antarctic environment, it's always a constant challenge.
It is. It is. I don't think so, to tell you the truth, because I think the masters of modern container ships or oil tankers have their own problems, quite different problems, and they are really stressful.
Commercial pressures.
Yes, commercial pressures, social pressures with multinational crews, pressures with associated with. They're all tied up with the commercial side. And. And the fact that you're arriving at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're working cargo straight away, you're out again 4 hours later, and you've got umpteen stresses on you. So I actually think that although the Antarctic bass master has his exciting moments, I think that in many respects, it's less stressful.
Did you ever get yourself embroiled in any international or political issues?
Not personally. I mean, before the Falklands, and post Falklands, we always, if we could, we would visit bases rather than go past a base in the Antarctic. In the 70s, rather than sail past an Argentinian base, we would generally stop, send in a boat, perhaps take some chocolate or something to them as a gift and just say hello. And there was a time when the Argentinians especially would ask you for your passport when you got ashore, but you would usually get over that with a little bit of banter and usually have a drink with them. There was a lot of alcohol in the Antarctic in the 1970s and 80s to some extent, and the ships drank their fair share, I think, as well.
I'm supposed to ask you about memorable characters. There's one name already cropped up. It's Tom Woodfield.
Tom Woodfield, yes.
Yeah. Now again, Jack Tolson suggests I talk to you about that because he obviously had a regard for you as a potential sea captain. And I wonder how you felt about him.
I'm full of admiration for Tom Woodfield. Full of admiration for most of the bass masters that I've actually sailed with.
Why was Tom
memorable? Tom was a master of the old school. He was a master of the old school. He was a stickler for discipline, for routines, for accuracy, and he wouldn't let any sort of slackness go by. He'd pick you up and be thoroughly annoying and irritating, but it's exactly what a junior officer actually needs. And I'm not talking about bass ships now, but in my present job I see so many ships, modern ships, where that doesn't exist, and that's exactly what those ships need in order to operate more efficiently and effectively. And Tom, he was good in many respects. He fought the cause of the ship's crews well with the office. He was tremendously knowledgeable about the Antarctic geography and working ice, surveying, and just the sort of person that's fairly easy to respect, really.
He was old school and you were newer school, is that fair to say?
Yes.
Did you actually pick up old school?
I think at that time, he was old, what you'd call old school, but he's fairly typical of ship masters that I'd sailed with. I think he stood out because of his experience in the Antarctic, and when you go down there, or when I went down there as a 23-year-old third mate, I knew nothing compared to Tom Woodfield. I mean, I would have had my chief officer's, my mate's certificate of competency, and I'd have had the experience in the South Pacific and in with Portline, but I knew nothing about ice navigation and the Antarctic and the work of the British Antarctic Survey, I learnt a lot, if not, I learnt a hell of a lot from Tom Woodfield. There was also on that ship, my first voyage, there was also Chris Elliott and Stuart Lawrence. So Stuart Lawrence was the chief officer and Chris Elliott was the second officer for a while. So Stuart had probably got about 3 or 4 years experience at that time, and Chris probably had 5 or 6 years experience. So one way or another, it was for me, it was it couldn't be better with all that experience to draw on. And an exciting voyage as well. We had I think that was the voyage where the ice cliffs collapsed, and it was either that one or the next one.
Are there other characters who spring to mind?
Stuart Lawrence, everybody would say that.
What was What was it about him?
He was just a bubbly character that was forever getting into trouble, but he trouble with the office. He was just
back in Britain.
Yeah, he was just fun to be around. I served with him for 15 years probably, and he and I was his chief officer, and he and I were, I think, a very good partnership, because he took the risks and I tempered them somewhat. In a nutshell, I would say that, but I thoroughly enjoyed sailing with Stuart, as I've enjoyed sailing with everybody else as well. But Stuart was good fun and a really, really good bass master, not as technically good as Tom Woodfield. But in other respects, nothing was too much trouble for him. He'd always try his hardest to get the job done for the FIDS. He was a Bransfield man, so it was FIDS rather than scientists. There was no we didn't have scientists on board the Bransfield. They were all FIDS, and it was an expedition, and Stuart would do his utmost to get the job done for them, and we all went along with that and did the same. And because it was a successful ship, a very, very successful ship at getting the job done, that good job satisfaction, high morale came along with that.
On the James Clark Ross, you had an officer called Donnelly who.
Yes.
Who had to go because he was dying.
Yeah.
What
well,
do you recall about that?
He was my chief engineer. He had stood by the ship with me in South Shields, and he was sailing with me for the first 2 years of the ship's life. He was a very good friend of mine, and he was getting slowly more ill. We had a doctor on board. We had a very experienced doctor on board, probably the most experienced bass doctor, and he couldn't get to the bottom of it. And with the benefit of hindsight, I should have made sure he was put off the ship and sent home or sent to hospital earlier, because there were, with the benefit of hindsight, there were enough indications there to show that would have been the sensible course of action. But John didn't want that. In fact, he was adamant that he didn't want that, and the doctor didn't support that either, basically. And I suppose that I wasn't a strong enough character to insist on it. I think Tom Woodfield might have done, but I wasn't, and that was the wrong decision. But that was the sad point of 22 years with the British Antarctic Survey. When we did get him ashore in Stanley, I mean, at that time I didn't think it was life threatening. I must admit, I knew he was ill, but I didn't think it was life threatening. And not until he actually got into the hospital and they started doing tests on him, and the prognosis was pretty poor. And it was around Christmas time, I remember distinctly as well, because they. I won't go into the whole thing, but I had a few days where I was pulling every string that I possibly could to get him transferred to Montevideo, get him flown with a special medical flight up to Montevideo, and in the end, it took me phoning the head of the forces in the Falklands at about 11 o'clock midnight on Christmas Eve, getting him out of bed and. to actually make it happen, and putting him or at least getting contacts in Aberdeen, Nelson Norman, who's worked with Bass and advised Bass. He got on board, and we were able to persuade the authorities in Stanley to fly him up there. But at least then his wife was able to fly out, and they were able to have a couple of days together before he finally succumbed to his illness.
What was the problem?
I don't know.
Right.
But it also there wasn't a certainty, but he had a fall off the roof of his house, and I think he had, and his wife agreed with me that it was from that time, which actually had occurred while we were standing by the ship in the building of the ship, that he had changed, his personality had changed, and his generally his character had changed, and I think, looking back on it, you could almost see a gradual decline from that time.
A couple of other questions of a different nature to finish on. I hear you're an artist. Tell me about your artistic prowess.
I really enjoyed David Smith's company, the artist that we took down south for a couple of years, and he. He took me under his wing and encouraged me to paint. I watched him on many hours on the bridge doing his watercolours, and I basically really enjoyed doing that as well.
No previous experience?
No.
So you started in the Antarctic?
I did, yes.
And painting, using lots of white, I presume. Right?
The terrific. That was one thing that David taught me, that to see the colours in things where one might see just different shades of white or grey or blue. There you could also put in purples and yellows and oranges and things and make the whole thing more interesting from a colour point of view, but also bring it all to life.
But what was a spark? Nick, you saw his work and thought, I can do that?
No. I think it's... I have to say, I think the spark, if there was one, is just admiring what... Yeah, I saw his work and admired it. I saw him actually creating this and admired the way that... And was surprised, I think, at the techniques and the colours and things that he was using. And I had a sudden... I suppose a moment of realization that the weakness of what a photograph can do, because I'd taken some quite reasonable photographs over the years, but these paintings captured the Antarctic for me far more than any photograph could, and I wanted to try and emulate that. And I actually learnt that I was never anything like as good as David, but I could produce a pretty reasonable picture, and did. I mean, a number of people actually liked them. There was one thing that was very disappointing for me, that remained disappointing, was that the senior FIDs on board on one trip really were desperate to get something to hang in they had their own, called the senior fiddery, or at least it used to be called the senior fiddery. They had their own common room where they, the people that were permanent Bass employees used to have as their recreation room. And they wanted something, a picture to hang on the wall, so they asked me to do something. And you can't just produce something like that. But they were desperate, and they took one of the paintings, that a mere sketch that I'd done, and the next minute I know it was framed and up on the wall. And I hated it, really.
Well, you should never judge your own work, should you?
No, it's awful. It was
so
an awful.
What were you doing? Were you standing on ice floes with an easel? And
oh, often on the wing of the bridge. But I've got a photograph of David and I actually on the sea ice at Halley Bay, where the ship was discharging. He was with his easel doing an oil painting of the ship, and I was about 20 or 30 metres away with another easel doing an oil painting of the ship.
You were using oils rather than...
I was doing oils there, but I use watercolours. I'm not particularly good. And since leaving Bass, I've done very, very little. And but it's something I mean to pick up again when I retire.
Did you detect, in your time in the Antarctic, anything beyond the visual beauty? Was there something about the Antarctic, something more spiritual behind that visual beauty, which you?
There may have been, but it's nothing that I've sort of identified, to tell you the truth. But there's no doubt about it that the Antarctic holds a very special place in my memory, and. Certainly, for those 22 years, it was the centre of my life, and I loved being down there. And when I left, I can't say that I couldn't wait to be back down there again, but there were elements of it that I couldn't wait to return to. But of course, it was also very nice to come home to the wife and children as well. Yeah, it's a very special place.